Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map. I've been reading a little thing about, I'm going to read it to you, about from Mr. Kirkland Ciccone. I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Is that like Madonna's real name?
Yes, yes. So how would you pronounce that?
I don't know, isn't it? Like Ciccone, I don't know.
It's Italian, right, yeah.
Ciccone, I don't know.
I have a little soundbite that tells us how to pronounce Kirkland's last name. So I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to play it for us as well, so we got it here.
Ciccone.
Ciccone. Yeah, two C's are pronounced K in Italian.
Yeah, Ciccone.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's an Italian Scotsman.
What a combination.
What a combination, yes.
That's a tricky one. That's a tricky one at closing time, I imagine.
Yeah, well, yes. He's written a book or two, and he wrote this article about the slits, and I thought a couple of quotes from there, and I want your impressions, because it did bring it kind of in more perspective to me. He said, "Everything I learnt about London came from an album called Cut by a band named The Slits. For me, London birthed punk, the real punk. It reshaped the lexicon of pop culture. For a while, there was an attraction to that city so acute that real happiness could only come my way if I went there and breathed its air, heard its noise, and felt its fear. The London I wanted to see was the one that The Slits told me all about." So I'm wondering, was that kind of your experience of London coming down from St. Helens, and was it informed by The Slits' viewpoint? Because they were probably some of the first people that you met, right?
Because I went down from Liverpool, so I'd left my hometown. I was with my first band, the Spitfire Boys.
Right.
And the Londoner, the London I met, apart from the first, like, we went down to record, like, the Spitfire Boys' one and only recording.
Right.
But we met up with the Slits. I think Paul was the key, Paul Rutherford, who later was in Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Right.
I think what happened was the Slits were on tour, and they had nowhere to stay when they got to Liverpool. And so Paul had probably either met them or reached out to them and said, "You can come stay at my place. Come stay at my mum's." So we had Slits staying with his mum out in like Cantrell Farm Estate somewhere, wherever it is.
Wow.
With their little bus outside. And so they became best of friends.
Right.
And so I think that could have been before Paul was a singer in Spitfire Boys.
Right. Right.
Therefore, when we went down to London, Paul had probably said, "We should go and like meet, you know,
right,
Barbara." There was a house where we stayed where I met Steve Strange,
okay,
who was also staying there.
Right,
that was like meeting like the Artful Dodger. So this might give you an idea of the London I met.
Right.
Steve Strange was pretty much, I think, a local kind of, he was known locally.
Yes.
Around the scene.
Yeah.
But he certainly wasn't a singer. He didn't have the makeup. He had bright socks on. You know, everybody had brothel creepers and bright day glow socks.
Yeah.
And Steve said to me, I said, I like your socks. He said, I'll show you where to get them from. And Steve, like, put me under his wing or arm and took me down the King's Road and showed me around where Boy was and the market there and Lloyd Johnson's place. And I had no money. I had no money at all. And don't think he did. So that's how we ate, because somebody had to show you how to. Got to pick a pocket or two, but it was really kind of going in a supermarket and slipping something in your pocket.
Paying for the
cheapest thing whilst everybody else is filling up.
Because you were starving little punkies, right?
Which is very much described in Shoplifting, which is one of the tracks on the album.
Right.
The album being Cut, the band being The Slits. We stayed with, the Spitfires stayed with Barbara, and Barbara was running a house for single parent, for mothers with a child, with a single parent family house. And she drove the Sex Pistols around.
Right.
That's what her gig was. A day job was the house.
Yeah.
And so we kind of landed on a kind of outer circle of the inner circle of punk, if you like.
Right.
And then we would sometimes go down to Ari's mum's house just behind the King's Road in Chelsea. Yes. Nora Forster, and Ariana. And of course, John Lydon was already kind of, I think, either had got a candle lit for Nora or was definitely wanting to... I don't know. I mean, I really don't. I imagine there could have well been an item already.
Okay. So everything was all sort of falling into place around that sort of nexus.
Right. Yeah.
In Kirkland's article, he also has a link to the video for Typical Girls, and you're in that. And
Typical Girls was because Typical Girls is the first song that it was not a song I remember from, because I'd seen the Slits play live.
Right.
You know, I'd gone to watch them at various places like the Fulham Greyhound or the Camden Music Machine.
Yeah.
And I don't recall Typical Girls being in the set. And none of the songs that ended up on Cut sounded like the versions that they played live with Parmalive, who was the co-writer of a lot of the lyrics, and along with Viv, who... was the other main lyric writer, and perhaps mostly the imagery on Cut is probably Viv's London world.
And isn't it interesting that, you know, fast forward, you know, 40 years and she's a writer. So, it's very interesting. I like to draw the connections here. So Parmalive was still a drummer when you first saw them. And so...
Yeah.
When Parmalive, she left, or was she asked to leave, or what happened? Do you know?
Well, I wasn't party to it, of course. I just heard they needed somebody. They were being managed by the same manager that I'd been. Again, I was taken under several wings Clive Langer from Deaf School. He kind of introduced me to Glenn Matlock. Mm-hmm. He introduced me to somebody who could, like, give me a day job so I could get a bit of money.
Right.
But mostly he introduced me to his manager, who was the manager of Deaf School, Frank Silver.
Right.
And Frank basically took me on. He used to bung me 25 quid a week, and if I was lucky.
Yeah.
And that's how I survived, really. And I imagine we didn't make a lot of money out of the Slits album. I don't know.
But was it the first sort of major... recording that you had done?
I think it was the first major label. Yeah, it was Island Records. I was like, wow, you know.
Yes,
I
mean, you're in from the Sticks.
I am.
It's your first major label project, right? And it's maybe attractive to you because, you know, it's like something real to do. And also, it's got Dennis Bovell, who is going to be the producer. And, you know, there's reggae involved, which you like, and Ireland. And I'll read you what Kirkland says about all this. He said, "What I hadn't known was that the album was punk, but not in the way I understood it at the time. What the fuck," I screamed, "this is reggae." Yes, it was. But that was punk too, for the Slits successfully took all those sounds and made them into punk, the real definition of the word before it became Mohawks and Pins. The producer of the album was Dennis Bovell, a genius who made skeletal-sounding dubby music sound enormous in your headphones. The songs on cut do not sound like anything from any other punk bands in the, on the scene in punk. The Slits stuck apart. Bovell's production allowed the Slits an opportunity to find gaps they could fit into, hold spaces to craft sounds uniquely their own.
It's a good appraisal of Dennis's work. He was I didn't meet him until we got to Ridge Farm Studios outside of London.
Is that where you recorded Cut out there?
Yep, Ridge Farm. It's a little residential studio. It's where the photographs were taken.
Yes, we're coming to the photographs.
We'll get there. But really, it was for me the key thing was the Slits had signed to Ireland, and so the meeting place was Chiswick, St. Peter's Square, the headquarters of Island Records. It was a big kind of Chiswick's a place of like larger houses that are set back in their own little gardens.
South of the river. Yeah.
South of the river, yes. Well, it was also, it would be the first port of call for musicians arriving from Jamaica who were coming in to work either as pickup, you know, either singers or musicians who were coming to work with people in London. It was a very close-knit Jamaican scene there.
Right.
But let's go back to the beginnings of that album.
Yeah.
I went down to Ariana's mum's house.
Yeah.
And Ariana opened the door.
Yeah.
She was wearing a pair of knickers and a T-shirt.
Right.
She was about 16 or 17. And she sort of giggled at me. And I went, I probably giggled back because I wasn't, you know, it's like, this is all a bit strange. But it was all very, very, you know, bright and nothing clandestine about it. It was, and she basically, Ari brought me in, took her into the house, which is a very nice house, and introduced me to her record collection.
Okay, what was she listening to?
Lots of soul, Marvin Gaye, Tamla Motown, and no punk. There was not on her, you know. I think the Bee Gees might have been on there. Saturday Night Fever had just come out, and she was like 16. She was into that,
right?
Yeah, because it had production, and she wanted production, and the band wanted to sound like a well-produced. They wanted to make a really well-produced record. They didn't want to make a cheap, kind of quick, punky record for Chiswick Records around the corner. You know, around the corner from Ireland, probably.
Right.
So they were not like a polished band that a polished label would want to sign.
Right.
And they were almost, they'd done a couple of Peel sessions, I know that. And they were chaos live.
Right.
They were lucky if they could keep a song going for the duration of the song. Palmolive, ferocious drummer, but terrible trouble keeping a beat going.
Right.
For 3 minutes.
Isn't it strange that most of the people who make unique and groundbreaking items generally see themselves as completely opposite to how the public ends up perceiving them, you know?
Viv, I remember meeting Viv, you know, a long time after the album had become like a cult classic.
Right.
And she was probably working for a production company for Channel 4 TV in London. And there was a new club open, one of those London clubs.
Yes.
And people were invited. And so I met Viv and said, "Hey, you know, wow, isn't it great? All these years, and the album is like still like lauded as like a really influential
right.
record. And she went, really? And I said, yeah, isn't it? And she went, as if like it had so much not a part of her world.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting, you know, thing that a lot of things that make a lot of other people very interested and you know stimulated by it usually are on the periphery of what a lot of artists are doing. It's like, really, that's the bit you like about me? And you know, it's not about self-awareness or anything. It's just about you have a skill that you've almost sidelined, and that's what people like. And it's a very strange phenomenon.
It might be even looking now, because to kind of look at it in a kind of a chronological way, because that's how I've always spoken about it.
Mm.
But in a way, I can look at it now and say, why did I sit down at Ridge Farm Studios in the glorious sunshine with Viv, who I admired and had a great fondness for her, and you know that we'd just been through, and I checked my diary, it's like 4 weeks of real the roller coaster of emotions. And she says in her book how it reduced her to tears of anger and frustration,
right,
and delight,
right,
because they really had to make those performances. Ariana was able to just roll out a piano flourish or a kind of 2.5-octave range in her voice, and Viv had all the ideas but was still kind of really having to struggle to find the right technique to get these parts right.
Right.
And I suppose in a way it was quite exhausting, and I wasn't sure if I just wasn't sure how this would continue. And as I say, I didn't leave to go anywhere. It was just, it felt like we'd achieved so much. And I think it was just exhaustion, really. Just, you know, we maybe need a break. I need a break from you. But then I never went back because I joined another band.
Right.
which changed my life again.
I'm reading an article that was in an English newspaper,
yeah,
a few years back, and it's Viv talking about the making of the album, and she describes several of the things that you're talking about. I'll read you this bit. It says, so in the spring of 79, we were dispatched to Ridge Farm in Surrey. Dennis was trapped with all these girls. He and Ari were very strict. I'd only been playing for 18 months and was with these control freaks. I often went to bed in tears, wondering what humiliation waited for me the next day, what weaknesses would be revealed in my playing. When I was playing Newtown, they kept saying, you're not getting it. By the end, I was so furious, I just thrashed at the guitar and made strange noises. Over the intercom came, that was fantastic. So it's like, you know, it's like it goes to that thing about, you know, what is your real strength and who are you, you know? And I think that makes a lot of really good records, because a lot of really good records, they come out of that intersection of passion and energy and creation, and so they're not contrived at all. They have that magic in it, and if it translates into the grooves, people, you know, they react to it.
Should I read you an interesting fact?
Okay, please do.
I'm holding in my hand...
Oh, my goodness. It's Budgie's diary. He's got his diary from 1979 in his hand.
It's called the London Diary, 1979. Do you remember these with a little pencil?
I do.
You put them in the top.
I do. Mine was very boring. Mine just said, get up, go to school, go to church, go to Scouts.
You've got a map of central London. You've the tube, the underground. Okay, here we go. It's April the 1st.
Yeah.
It's a Sunday. We'd met the day before at St. Peter's Square. 31st of March, and we were leaving for Surrey. So that April the 1st, April Fool's Day, is also Passion Sunday.
Right. Ooh.
You just mentioned passion.
Blimey. I got a chill up my spine then. I'm thinking about it, how we've lodged into this. Wow.
I know. We just, prior to that, right up until the day before we left, Friday the 30th, we did 5 days rehearsal. That wasn't the only rehearsal we did, but it was 5 days rehearsal. In the midst of which was a new moon.
Right.
And by the fourth day, we were into the first quarter of the new moon.
Mm.
And we went all the way through. Consults his, you can hear me just turn the pages of this old. We're almost around to the next new moon by the time we finished. It was right the way through Easter. We may have taken Easter Day and a bank holiday off.
Mm.
We got to the last quarter and that was coming towards the end of the session. It was basically a four-week session from April the 1st through till April 23rd. So, yeah, that's 3 weeks, actually. Calendar weeks.
That's pretty intensive time. I mean, that's a lot longer than we had for the first two albums, I think, of the Cure. So it's good. I'm going to read you the next bit from this because this article in the Guardian,
okay.
Because it really sums up a bit of what you were saying as well. It said, Dennis corralled us into shape and tied up all the ends, but without trampling on creativity. This is Viv speaking. It was so rare for a man in the 1970s to put himself inside the heads and hearts of four crazy young women. Budgie also helped pull it all together. Ari was very communicative about how things should sound, and Budgie could take that from a girl who was 17. He had a feminine sensibility. They were extraordinary men to come across. Ari, in her German Jamaican accent, would tell them exactly what she wanted from the hi-hat.
She had detail in mind, always an eye for detail. The thing about Ari, the thing that I got straight away from that first meeting that night when we went around to her mum's house and she showed me, played me a record collection, was as she was playing the records, the music, she started to do this thing. She wasn't dancing because she was moving around and skipping around and dancing.
Right.
But she sat on a chair and she rocked. Wow. She rocked backwards and forwards like a pendulum into the back of the chair.
Okay.
All the weight going into the backward movement. I'm doing it now. And that's what I used to do, the same thing at home on a Saturday night when I was listening to my records.
Ooh.
I'd swing.
Ooh.
I'd pound the chair to the beat.
Yeah.
And Ari did it. And the moment she started, I went, oh my God, somebody else does that.
Yeah. So you had a connection straight away there then?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a total connection. It was just, she smiled. I remember her smiling and I remember reciprocating that smile because it was like a smiling of, I know what you're doing. I know exactly what it is. This is the beat. This is how the music moves you. And it was a passion
right.
for music, a passion for beat, a passion for the deeper current of music. It wasn't to do right. with style.
No.
It wasn't to do with what was fashionable.
Right.
It was to do with a deeper pulse.
Well, so what you channel, what you could get together through it, that's what made it. I mean, it's still today, I've been listening to it again. Still very unusual record and really unusual for the time, you know?
Yeah.
So it's got a lot of...
Viv, I think Viv had the hardest job in many ways.
Yeah.
Apart from when Tessa was asked to sing one of Parmalee's lyrics.
Right.
She had to sing Adventures Close to Home because Parmalee had wanted her to.
Oh, okay.
And Tessa and Parmalee, I think, used to share a flat together.
Okay.
And Ari might have... She could have made it up that Parmalee said, no, you've got to sing. No, you've got to sing it.
Okay.
Tessa. Yes. Tessa, you've got to sing it, Tessa. And Tessa was just so laid back. You know, she was not a lady of many words.
Right.
And so I think it was from Tessa where I really felt the bass to be this, you know, an instrument of a deeper, something that came from a deep part of the inner.
Right.
Body.
And know. Something also to ground the eccentricity, you know, and the craziness of what else is going on. Yeah.
We just play grooves.
Right.
If you think of Newtown, it's just we set up a beat, boom, 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 and it's hypnotic. And then that's where Viv had to really be inventive and find the gaps and not just play the chord shapes. So it was invention all the time, and that really is demanding and tiring and creatively exhausting. Mm. And we ate well.
Good.
They had on-site catering at Ridgefront Studios, you know.
Always good.
And it was a country farmhouse, and there was a big table, and there was food. It was fantastic.
Yeah. So that's good. That's going to make people, you know, young people feel better. Yeah.
We had no money to be eating.
Right.
Certainly, we didn't cook. No. I didn't cook. No. I didn't go out to restaurants. No. I was lucky if I got, like, you know, those kind of Camden Town greasy breakfasts.
Oh, right, the greasy spoon. Yes.
Yeah, that was what I looked forward to. Sausage, eggs, bacon.
Right.
You know, I wasn't even vegetarian then.
Right.
And it was just and baked beans.
Baked beans.
Two slices of toast and a cup of tea.
Right. Or fried bread. Fried bread. You have to have fried bread.
Never had fried bread. I was a two-slice toast man, you know.
So I suppose the other thing, because I'll read you something else from Dennis.
From Dennis, right.
He said, Chris Blackwell from Island Records told me, I've signed this group and I don't know what to do with them. It's a girl group, a punk band. He gave me some cassettes of them live and I thought, yeah, they certainly can play, and I agreed to do the album. We were in the studio for 10 weeks and it was solid work. The band had clear ideas about what they wanted. Ari, Tessa and Viv had written songs. They just needed me to shape them. Worked from 9 in the morning to late. I'd tell them, off you go to bed, so I could fix things. And Ari would say, no, I'm not going to bed. She would always insist on being there if I was doing anything to the music.
Yeah.
It's like that dichotomy, you know, like this wild person that people probably looked at, you know, some other more adult people looked at and thought, well, you know, what is that going on there? But actually she was very committed to what she was doing. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Did you say he said 10 weeks in the studio?
Yeah, we were in the studio for 10 weeks. That's what he said. I don't know.
No, the reason is we cut all the tracks.
Yeah.
We cut the tracks for cut.
Yeah.
All the drums, bass, guitars, most of the vocals, probably piano. Right. A lot of that was done. A lot of the vocals probably came in the next session. Oh, I left on the 24th.
Okay.
And I didn't play these songs after. Mm-hmm. At all with the Slits, because Bruce did.
Okay.
Because Bruce came down, I think, for the only thing he put on the album was a little vocal part.
Right.
But I think I remember Just One More Mix is like a cartoon on the inner sleeve of a cut, and like engineers walking around with their arms outstretched, sleepwalking. They took a long time laying over all those percussion overdubs and little bits of this, and they also took a lot of time getting the mixes the way they wanted them. So 4 weeks for the basic recording?
Yeah.
Sounds like 6 weeks for mixing.
Right, absolutely. Well, it sounds good. I mean, still. I mean, I listened to it on headphones and it's got that space in it, that dub space is going on there. Yeah.
There's a reason for that as well. There's a reason I found out that none of us knew that Dennis was what, and Dennis, this is from Dennis's own interview somewhere I read, that he was moonlighting, and so he was doing the Slits in the day,
right?
And he was going into London, and he was doing Forces of Victory, Linton Kwesi Johnson's seminal dub poet album,
right, absolutely huge.
So it had all things like Sonny's Letter and, you know, Gonna Smash Their Brains In. It was a really powerful album that we played a lot, and no idea that these two things were happening back to back. So Dennis was bringing the vibe of the, you know, the personification of dread poetry, you know, from Brixton.
Right.
And the musicians from Jamaica as well, you know, the musicians and the rhythm section on that album and the production as well. But the flavor of that certainly came in. But the rejection of punk, looking for something that wasn't what people were terming punk.
Right.
So it was a hybrid. It was a hybrid between those two things. The Slits didn't have a history of playing in other bands, of playing cover versions,
right? So they
getting to know other people's songs. They came at it playing their music. They didn't, right. And never played anybody else's music. And then if you cross that with a very a strong reggae musician who had roots in rock and roll as well,
yeah,
but who was working on a groundbreaking reggae album with a groundbreaking artist, I think that combination. Perhaps it, you know, that maybe the home that they found in Island Records was very fortunate and made it the way it, you know, the way it was.
Wow. So we'll get on now to the cover, because the cover is somewhat unique, and it's probably one of the most well-known covers from a band ever, I would think, really, in lots of ways. I'm going to read you the two things from the articles that I've read about the cover. Mm. So this is from Kirkland Chacon, and he tells us about the cover. The cover photograph is famous for showing the band bare-chested, wearing loincloths, their bodies soaked and dried in Surrey mud. But there's nothing inviting about that shot, for the slits look fearsome. You don't ever see a band look that combative on their CD cover art. Simply put, the slits look like they could kick the shit out of you if you cross them. Maybe they'd pogo on your spine once you were down for the count. God, I thought they're perfect. And that's his viewpoint on it. And then Dennis said, I got a bit of a shock when they did the cover. I went off to have a quick dip in the pool while they were shooting it. When they finished, the owner's son said, why don't you jump in the pool to get the mud off? I said, no, but I jumped in anyway. There's a photo of me in there with them. I've tried to get hold of the negative.
I know. Yeah, because you see, really, Dennis was like, you know, at the end of the early evening, he'd always be on the phone to his mum. All right, mum.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be on for dinner. Right. You know, it was like, it was lovely. There was a lot of, Dennis was larger than life and a joy to be with. And you know, we haven't met since that time ever. And I hope the day will come when we can say hello again.
Yes.
But I imagine I could so much see him with these like three girls covered in mud, no clothes on, just jumping in the pool. And nothing suggestive at all, because it's just not the way, you know. It's a funny thing, isn't it? They Viv was quite, how do you put it? I can't, this Ariana was like very young and very precocious and very crazy and very, Tessa was just cool and nothing really
fazed her, right?
Viv was fire, you right. know, she there was there's a lot of more experience. There was more life experience coming through. There was the challenge of being a woman, and
right. And
Viv was the embodiment of everything the slits were singing about, really.
Right. I'm going to give you the quote then from you know, I have tricks up my sleeve here. I'm going to give you the quote from Viv about that shot, and she says pretty much what you said. The album cover was shot in the Rose Garden. We wanted a warrior stance, to be a tribe. We were egging each other on. The next thing you know, we were sitting in the mud, smearing it over each other. We knew, since we had no clothes on, that we had to look confrontational and hard. We didn't want to be inviting to the male gaze. And I mean, you know, when you look at the cover, that's it. They look like a tribe of warriors, you know. That's what I get from that.
It was a time when reggae artists, soul artists would feature a scantily clad woman on the cover. There was that early, you know, that hangover from the 70s and 60s,
yeah.
Which feminine nudity on an album sleeve was something they thought might sell more copies, you know.
Right, it was taken from a more misogynistic point of view as opposed to what the slits were trying to promote there, right.
There would have been a greater one, especially from Viv,
right.
of how it could be perceived,
right.
And so it, I think she said it really. The photo shoot was with Penny Smith.
Okay.
They knew Penny Smith very well. A lot of us knew Penny Smith's work from The Enemy, The Rose Garden. Because if you investigate closely, you'll see the drain pipe on the cottage and the roses climbing the wall, the whitewashed wall. It was a traditional English countryside garden.
Right. Surrey Country Garden, right.
And so it is. There's nothing around the ambience that says photo studio, guy behind the camera, woman put in to sell more units, you know, that kind of a photo shoot. This was not.
Well, I think it's a very very striking image in the way that promoted that sort of that punk feminism that was starting to come up with people like, you know, Polystyrene and the Slits. And then obviously we go a little further and we go to the next person that you encounter.
Oh, the Madame Banshee.
Madame Banshee, yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. That's the first time I saw. Would it be the first time? First time I saw the Banshees in London, I was actually with the Slits.
Right.
Not playing with them, but like hanging out side stage.
Okay, so tell me something, because I know that our listeners want to know this. What did Ari and Viv think of Sue?
Well, I don't know that Ari would have an opinion on anybody. Okay. I know what she thought of the Sex Pistols.
Yeah. Well, okay. And?
They thought Steve and Paul, guitarist and drummer, were brickies. He said, they're just bricklayers.
Oh, dear.
It wasn't like they didn't have a high opinion of them.
No.
They were just... Nothing about them would be, you could take that seriously.
Okay.
They didn't really express, they had fun with everything.
Okay.
And how they see Susie, I don't know. They were aware, I think, that they were in the same scene.
Right.
I think they were very aware that Susie was a strong woman.
Right.
I know that if I can be a fly on the wall and see that photo shoot, I think it might have been for the Sounds or for the Enemy, and it was called like something typical, like, you know, Women in Punk or something, where they had Debbie Harry, Chrissy Hynde.
Oh, yes. Albertine, I've seen that.
Polystyrene, Pauline Black, Susie. And I think Pauline Black said, the only thing we have in common is we're all women and we're in bands.
Yeah.
You know, there was no kind of common politic or common attitude.
Right.
But they were all in it for different reasons, all very personal. And I suppose that's what misses when you have an article like that. You're trying to put them into, these are all very strong women in bands.
Yeah.
It's like you could do the same with guys, but I think guys might have a bit more to talk about in terms of the bands that made them get into bands. I can't speak for any of the other people in that photograph apart from Susie. But she never wanted to be in a band, any old band.
Right.
She didn't want to, like, I must be a singer in a band. I really got to do that. You know, I want to find the right band for me. As might have been, I don't know what Debbie Harry wanted to do, if that was a thing. Or I'm reading Chrissy's book. She just seemed to be on the periphery of bands all the time, hanging out with bands. That certainly wasn't the way Susie was, like, hanging out with the gay crowd in crazy discotheques in London. Yeah. You know, she was just looking for somebody she could fit in with somehow.
Right.
And I think the Slits found their gang. You know, I'm just thinking, was it Palmolive's idea to get the band together? So Palmolive was already a fish out of water, being from like Paloma in Spain. Mm. And she met Joe Strummer, and she was Joe's girlfriend. And so she was with one of the scene changers.
Right.
And she was right there on the inside, and she was like strong, and she was ferocious. Palmolive was ferocious.
Right.
Viv says in her book, there's a great quote, because the time of the Slits is only a very small section of that first book she wrote.
Right.
But she said it was like such a
crushing, you know, when the band split. Right. And she felt like, did she say she felt like Nicole, a sycamore pod spinning in the breeze? Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, it was like, what do I do now? Forward many years when I eventually split from the band I joined afterwards and when they folded. I mean, we were a lot many more years down the line, but I realized that day after the tracks had been done, and now we're talking through it. I had rehearsed with the Slits, and we'd started to do demos early on for what would become Cuts. So the first song I did with the Slits was Typical Girls.
Right, right.
That song was worked out from scratch. It was Viv's lyric. I'm pretty sure of that.
Right.
And they knew what they had. They had the bass line, and with a couple of different producers they'd been working with, we worked on that particular song like for days, trying out different ways. And so we started to work on some of the songs like Shoplifting, FM. So these would have been the songs that we then played live on the Clash tour.
Okay.
Because many years later, when I finally touched base with Topper, drummer with the Clash, Topper was saying, I said, how great it was watching you, Topper, every night, you know, keeping that massive band sound together. You were like, I was watching you.
I know. I knew you were going to say that, because I knew he would be, because like, for me, I listened to Cut as a drummer, and things like Typical Girls, it's got such there's the genesis to me of your inimitable style. I can hear it right there. Wow. Even before then, you know, even before the Banshees, before everything, I can hear it right there. And so I know what Topper means.
He was saying you were getting better by the day. And it was like that 1,000-hour thing, you know, the outlines.
Right, yes.
Because I realized when I hit London in 1979, the Slits was my first major label, but I was in studios pretty much like every day. I was doing something with somebody. But I'd done a lot of intense work. Rehearsal with like Big in Japan and the Spitfires, but mostly with Big in Japan.
Right.
And when I got to London, I knew about rehearsing and I knew about a little bit about studios. And that's really what I'd done with the Slits, was walked in and I knew what the job, what they needed.
Right.
And I knew what I could bring to it whilst keeping this, as I said, the spirit of Palmolive and the essence of the band intact.
So really, I suppose, you know, in the final thought about it is that it was of double benefit. It was a benefit to them because they got an excellent percussionist, and it was a benefit to you because you got to, you know, put your ducks in a row and kind of line up things to know how you should be. I'm going to leave you with one phrase from our good friend Kirkland here and ask you to comment on it. It's a very poetic way of thinking of things, but, you know.
Okay.
He said, some songs, just like the scenes they spawn from, are cities. Punk was London. Cut is London. And London is better left in the imagination or the chords of a good song. And I kind of see it, That early, you know, late 70s, early 80s part when I was living in London as well, in that way, you know, it's like a lot of those albums, like the Clash's first album, like Cut and that, they describe a city, but the city is bigger than its environment as well. It's also all the people like yourself and, you know, like us and like me, it's all those people that came into the city at that time because it was the nexus of creative regeneration. And that's what really made the place special at that time. I'm not sure if it's like that anymore. I haven't been there for a while, but I definitely felt that feeling then. And from, you know, what you've been telling us, it's very much the place where you started to see what your future could be.
I think I think that's true. If I had one thing to say to try and say to like to land that, that the city is wrapped up in the chords of the songs that came out of it. It was a London that was, it didn't have a lot of money. It was a bit like what the New York you and I met
right.
in the end of the 80s, you know, the mid-80s, beginning of the 80s, mid-80s. But London was, the people that were active, like Malcolm McLaren, Vivian Westwood, Neil Stevens and Banshee's manager, Barbara, who looked after the Pistols, and Linda, who was around. People like Steve Strange were coming into London and movers from other parts of Britain.
Movers and shakers all coming in.
So, yeah, anything was kind of doable. There was a lot of squats. There was a lot of empty buildings.
Yes, I remember that.
So it, you could come to London and you could just crash on people's floors or in empty flats around Euston, around King's Cross, around Kilburn, Camden. Yeah. There was a network of knowledge of where to get food, where how to get by, how to make a bit of money, where to sign on. Yeah. This is like benefits. And then, of course, there were clubs like the Vortex in Wardour Street.
Right.
And Andy Sosowski's club, you know, the Roxy. Yeah. But these were not just like, well, like local bands went to like the Nashville Rooms or, you know, Hope and Anchor, the pub gigs that had been traditional. Right. These were new venues that were happening because of what was happening around the country. And people from Birmingham and Liverpool and Manchester, we were gravitating to London.
Right.
It was one of those kind of moments in a city's history where money was scarce and ideas were flowing around.
Right.
I was going to give you one last thing. Mm-hmm. I'd come down to London. My day one rehearsal for the Slits was March the 2nd, 1979, okay? But I still had my little bed set in Liverpool. And I had to pay a month's rent.
Uh-oh.
Guess how much it was?
I'm going to say £10.07 and 6p.
That's very very novel and sweet. But you're not far wrong, you see. A month's rent on my little bed sit in Liverpool on Gambier Terrace opposite the Anglican Cathedral was £26.40.
Oh, my goodness. Like, well, so for
that's a pound a day.
Yeah, and for our American listeners, we could say that's equivalent to paying about $40-$50 a month for a studio. So that's that's pretty good.
It was a studio, makes it sound very grand. It was literally a room at the back of a house at the top. It was very Spike Milligan, a bed sitting room. But and I think for for my contribution to the Slits album, I was paid the princely sum and a refurbished drum kit in two tranches. £350.
Ooh.
Now, you see, if you do put £350 against a monthly rent of £26.
You were paid pretty well. A lot better than you'd get from streaming nowadays, I think.
I had a place to book. I couldn't live in Liverpool and do that. But it was a magic time. It's lovely to share those memories with your good self.
Yeah, I think our listeners will appreciate all of that. So it was very interesting for me as well. I learned more about it all.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.